Good afternoon, Your Honor.
Good afternoon.
May it please the Court, my name is Judson Littleton, and I'm here on behalf of the United States. And I'd like to start by explaining why we're here. A little more than a year ago, a challenge was brought on equal protection grounds to Section 3 of DOMA in a circuit with no binding precedent on the level.
One second, please.
Sure.
I'm embarrassed to say this, but my knee bumped the button. 50,000 U.S. Marshals out in the hallway.
Be careful what you argue.
Certainly don't want to get in their way. We need to take care of them.
Thank you.
Sure. So back to the reason that the United States is here in this case, Your Honor. A little more than a year ago, a challenge was brought to Section 3 of DOMA on equal protection grounds in a circuit that had no binding precedent on the applicable level of scrutiny to laws that classify on the basis of sexual orientation. And after considered analysis of the factors that the Supreme Court has set forth that courts should consider when determining whether to recognize a new suspect or quasi-suspect class, the President and the Attorney General determined that laws that classify on the basis of sexual orientation should be subject to heightened scrutiny, and that Section 3 of DOMA fails that standard. Accordingly, when we received the notice of the constitutional question here in another circuit that does not have binding precedent, the only other circuit other than the second, that does not have binding precedent on the applicable level of scrutiny to those classifications, we thought it was important, it would be useful for us to appear here and to inform the court of the reasons for that determination and why the Department of Justice is no longer defending that statute in courts across the nation. Of course, as you've heard a lot of argument and seen in the briefs, it may not be necessary for the court to reach DOMA at all in this case. The United States wishes to emphasize here, as we stated in our brief, that DOMA, operating through ERISA in the Internal Revenue Code, does not impose a blanket prohibition on private pension plans providing benefits to same-sex spouses. There are two forms of benefits that ERISA and the Internal Revenue Code require be provided to same-sex spouses, and those are considered the Qualified Joint Survivor Annuity, Qualified Pre-Retirement Survivor Annuity. So long as DOMA is in effect, it requires that those particular benefits and the right of first refusal, as I believe someone else had characterized it, that those statutory mandated benefits require. If the benefits at issue are those benefits cannot be provided to a same-sex spouse so long as DOMA is in effect. But if the court determines in interpreting the COSIN plan at issue here that those are not the benefits that are contested here, or that there is another way to interpret the plan and that the benefits that are contested between the parties here are not those exact statutorily mandated benefits, then DOMA itself, operating through ERISA and the Internal Revenue Code, would not prohibit the plan from providing those to a spouse, to a same-sex spouse. As we've said in our brief, whether or not the COSIN plan does that is a matter of plan interpretation, and we leave that to the court and take no position on it. Turning to the equal protection question regarding Section 3 of DOMA, I think it's useful. We've talked a lot about factors, and in the briefs, a lot has been mentioned of the specific factors, and those are very important, and we will certainly talk about them. But I think it's important to take a step back first and think about what we are asking when we decide whether or not to recognize a new quasi-suspect or suspect class. And I'll look to the Supreme Court the way it characterized it in a case that was mentioned before, Plyler versus Doe. And the court said, some classifications are more likely than others to reflect deep-seated prejudice rather than legislative rationality in pursuit of some legitimate objective. And in other words, in light of a history of discrimination against a particular characteristic, and in light of the sort of lack of relation to any legitimate policy objectives that that particular characteristic has, do courts have reason to look at laws that treat that group differently with heightened skepticism? And really, is there a reason to examine those laws much more closely than we typically afford Congress when it is legislating in the areas of economic policy or social policy.
How do you balance this weighing of factors? In other words, when the argument's made that there is a growing political prowess, and yet an argument is made that no other class that's been mentioned that has yet to reach that status has had a history of outward, direct, physical violence against them, other than the gay community. How do you weigh, and what weight do you give to one versus the other in terms of deciding whether it should be rational basis or heightened scrutiny?
Well, Your Honor, looking at the cases in which the Supreme Court has determined that some form of heightened scrutiny should apply, in every case of which we are aware, the court has found a history of discrimination, some sort, and has found that that characteristic is generally not relevant to policy objectives that Congress can traditionally take into account. It has also discussed political powerlessness. That is a factor that we've discussed in our brief because the court often mentions it. I will note that in Frontiero, when the Supreme Court first said that gender was subject to heightened scrutiny, by that time, women had had the right to vote for 50 years. There was a constitutional amendment pending, the Equal Rights Act, that the court noted. Congress had enacted Title VII, which prohibited discrimination on the basis of gender. And the court pointed those out and in fact, noted that those political gains were actually more indicative of the discrimination that women had suffered in the past, and said, well, look, if these are the sorts of laws that people are enacting, then that really says something about the discrimination that they have faced. And so we interpret Frontiero as not holding that political powerlessness is a necessary finding for heightened scrutiny. The same with Matthews versus Lucas, which is the case in which the court recognized that some form of heightened scrutiny applies to discrimination on the basis of illegitimacy. The court did not discuss the political powerlessness factor in that case. Excuse me. And we would suppose that if this was a rigid four-factor test that had to be met in every case, then the court would have at least said something about it. So looking at those cases, we do not interpret the political powerlessness aspect as being an on and off switch. I will say that, in looking at some of the gains that have been cited by the parties and cited by Blagg in its briefs, and that a majority of Americans now would agree to vote for an openly gay president, or there is one federal judge who has been confirmed and there have been four others nominated. I think the fact that we are touting those as accomplishments, like Frontiero, really says something about the level of discrimination that gays and lesbians have suffered in the past. And indeed, as the court is aware, many of the gains that the gay and lesbian community has made in the past have been met with significant backlash. The Maryland and the Washington laws that were recently passed, they're both up for referenda, and according to news reports, there's a significant chance that those laws might not survive the referenda in the fall. Proposition 8, as the court is aware of. There's also recent news reports that New Hampshire, I think there's a bill for repeal of the New Hampshire law granting same-sex marriage to couples. And this is in addition to laws that were confronted by the courts in Romer versus in Romer and in the Equality Foundation, or excuse me, yes, Equality Foundation case out of the Sixth Circuit, which were in essence laws meant to repeal anti-discrimination and to remove laws that were added protections for the gay and lesbian community.
If you recognize that, in terms of rational basis, that there are some points that historically are noteworthy, praiseworthy, and valuable in terms of the quote-unquote betterment of society and for the benefit, I question if the court were to grant a ruling and decide that it was unconstitutional, including Pennsylvania DOMA, what, if any, effect there would be on other things. If we look at the Internal Revenue Code,
married filing jointly, even something at common law such as tenancy by the entireties as a benefit, does that mean that those things would have to also become same-sex available?
Well, at least with respect to federal laws, that's absolutely correct, Your Honor. DOMA, as counsel for Black just stated, DOMA does not say anything about who can or cannot get married, but what it does say is for the myriad of federal benefits, you know, thousands of federal statutes like being able to file jointly on your tax return, that if you are married to a person of the same sex and that marriage is recognized by your state, you cannot take advantage of that federal benefit. And in that sense, DOMA is tremendously broad. It does affect a wide range of statutes and federal regulations. And because Your Honor mentioned...
And is rational basis in that milieu something that is appropriate to consider when you think about the tax dollars? I think Mr. Feedback may have mentioned that. Someone mentioned that earlier in terms of the financial reduction available for governmental operations.
Would like to make
expanding the class. Is that something that the court even should be concerned about in terms of a rational basis?
Well, Your Honor, I wish to be clear that we are not, we've not addressed rational basis in our brief. We are not defending DOMA under any level of scrutiny, and I'm not able to take a position.
You might be an unbiased arbiter.
I'm not able to take a position on the outcome under rational basis, but what we would say is that after consideration of the factors that the Supreme Court has set forth, we think heightened scrutiny is clearly appropriate. And under heightened scrutiny, it's clear that just a decision to an intent to conserve the public fisc or to save tax dollars is not sufficient. You can't, while Congress has an interest in preserving the public fisc, it may not meet that interest under heightened scrutiny simply by singling out a particular class and excluding those benefits from that class. So we would say that under heightened scrutiny, which we feel is appropriate, that would not be a sufficient objective to uphold DOMA's constitutionality. I would note, Your Honor, that another important feature of the matter that you have before you, if you do reach DOMA's constitutionality, is that because you do not have any binding precedent, you have the freedom, and in fact, we would urge you to do so, to engage in analysis of those factors. And the 11 circuits that have been trumpeted before you today as holding that rational basis is appropriate, only two of them made any significant attempt at all to engage in an analysis of those factors that the Supreme Court has set forth. And those two cases, there's one out of the Federal Circuit called Woodward, and there's one out of the Ninth Circuit called High Tech Gaze. Both of those cases relied significantly on the fact that Bowers versus Hardwick was still the law at that time. And those cases said, well, if the Supreme Court has told us that you can criminalize same-sex sexual behavior, then of course it would make no sense to afford some form of heightened scrutiny to sexual orientation under the Equal Protection Clause. And those cases relied not only on Bowers, but they also relied on the fact in some way that it arose in the military context. And those courts found that because it arose in the military context, that there was some heightened deference that should be given even over and above that. So that even though those courts are the only ones that have engaged in analysis of the factors before the Galinsky Court just a few weeks ago, and those courts, the reasoning has been completely undermined by the fact that Bowers versus Hardwick is no longer good law, and this case doesn't arise in the military context. So there's no impediment to this court to engaging in analysis of those factors, and we would urge it to do so. With respect to a couple of other issues about how the factors play out, there's been some suggestion that the history of discrimination, because it does not amount to political disenfranchisement, might not be sufficient here. And we just wish to urge that there's no indication that the history of discrimination that we've outlined in our brief and that no party, I think, has really contested is true, and the awful abuses that gays and lesbians have suffered, there's no indication that that should be devalued simply because they were never the right to vote was never taken away from gays and lesbians as a class. There's no indication from the Supreme Court that that's necessary. And as I said in Frontiero, women had the right to vote for 50 years before Frontiero decided that discrimination on the basis of gender should be subject to heightened scrutiny. With respect to immutability, I'd just like to point out to the court that in a decision called Nyquist from the Supreme Court, the court confronted this exact question. The class in Nyquist was resident aliens, and they were denied under New York statute the ability to obtain some financial assistance and other educational benefits. And the court addressed the argument that resident aliens who are eligible for citizenship could voluntarily remove themselves from the class just by applying for citizenship and giving away their Canadian or their British citizenship, I believe. And the court said that that didn't affect its analysis as to whether heightened scrutiny was appropriate for resident aliens, and in fact confirmed that heightened scrutiny was appropriate. And in any event, when it comes to sexual orientation, that is something that we agree is innate to an individual. And it's very dear to the core of that person's being. And it's not something that, even if it were hypothetically possible to change one's sexual orientation, and we think that the overwhelming scientific consensus says that it's not, and that that's actually dangerous to try and change people in that way. Even if it were hypothetically possible, that's not something that we should ask people to change in order to avoid discrimination and avoid being treated differently from similarly situated people. With respect to the fourth factor, the relation to legitimate policy objectives, just wish to reiterate that this factor is, in fact, more general. There's been some argument in the briefs that say that point back to the rational bases that the parties have sort of articulated and said, well, obviously, because there are rational bases for the law, this fourth factor is not satisfied. We'd like to emphasize that it's more broad than that. And as the court in Cleburne said, we should look to the likelihood that governmental action premised on a particular classification is valid as a general matter, not merely to the specifics of the case before us. So when you consider whether or not heightened scrutiny should be afforded to gay and lesbian individuals, it's not whether you can find any rational basis, because in essence, that would be just importing the rational basis inquiry into the determination of whether heightened scrutiny applies. And even with gender, we know that's not true, because the court has repeatedly stated with respect to gender that gender is relevant to some policy objectives. It's, as a general matter, are there reasons that a legislative body might treat this class of people differently? In age is one of the cases which is mentioned this fourth factor as a reason not to recognize a quasi-suspect class, but we know that age is sometimes relevant to policy considerations that Congress can make with respect to Medicare and retirement ages and things like that. Same with mental retardation, which was in question in the Cleburne case. The court recited the numerous legislative initiatives that have been enacted to sort of assist people who are mentally disabled to participate better and be full members of society. And in light of those policy objectives that are furthered by that legislation, the court said that heightened scrutiny was inappropriate. Your Honor, I think that other than the decision whether heightened scrutiny should apply to classifications on the basis of sexual orientation, I don't think that there has been much argument. There's been some argument in the Farley's brief that the tradition-based rationales that they have articulated in defense of restricting marriage to opposite sex only, that passes heightened scrutiny. But I don't think that I heard counsel for Blagg to have argued that it would pass heightened scrutiny if you determine that heightened scrutiny is appropriate. I'll just point out that with respect to tradition, the Supreme Court has said in the VMI case that in the 150-year tradition of VMI as a same-sex institution and all the wonderful things about the single-sex educational policy that the court confronted there, that wasn't sufficient by itself under heightened scrutiny. And in fact, I'll point out that Justice Scalia in his Lawrence dissent has said that calls just to tradition and to defending the traditional institution of marriage is almost equivalent to expressing moral disapproval. And I don't understand any of the parties to have argued that moral disapproval by itself can be sufficient basis to uphold the statute on heightened scrutiny. And I'd like to, as the predicate issue which I have skipped over and which we feel the need to redress is the Baker versus Nelson point. The court has told us that summary dismissals for lack of a substantial federal question, they are adjudications on the merits, and they are binding on the precise issues presented and necessarily decided by the court. For one thing, the issues presented to the court in Baker versus Nelson were whether a Supreme Court decision interpreting an ordinance about what marriage was in Minnesota, whether it was required under the Equal Protection Clause that be interpreted to include couples of the same sex. That is far afield from the question here, which is a legislative enactment of Congress that says nothing about who can get married, but only says that if you are this kind of married couple and if you are this sexual orientation, then you don't count as married for purposes of federal law. So we would say that is not a precise issue that's presented in the Baker versus Nelson case. And additionally, we don't know much of anything about what the court decided in Baker versus Nelson. It's possible that the court thought that this question there was subject to heightened scrutiny. And under heightened scrutiny, you have to examine the actual justifications for the law. And if the court had determined that heightened scrutiny was appropriate, it would have examined the actual justifications in support of the Minnesota holding. Just as here, if you hold that heightened scrutiny is appropriate, you will have to examine the actual justifications for DOMA. Because we don't know anything about what those justifications were,
the legislative history and the testimony, right?
Correct, and that's right, Your Honor. And here we do know. So you can look at the House report, and you should look at the House report as the definitive articulation of the rationales for DOMA. But we don't know what the court thought about the situation in Baker versus Nelson. So my point is only that because we don't know what the Supreme Court decided about heightened scrutiny or decided about what reasons might meet heightened scrutiny, it really doesn't foreclose the issue in this case. And I'll also note that none of the appellate authority that the parties have cited for being controlling in their respective circuits on the level of scrutiny have relied at all on Baker versus Nelson. And the Supreme Court, when it's confronted this issue a couple of times in Romer and in Lawrence, has not said anything about Baker versus Nelson. So we don't think that Baker versus Nelson at all acts as an impediment to you engaging in the analysis of the four factors is appropriate here. As we've articulated in our brief, we think that an analysis of those factors leads to the conclusion that discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation is subject to heightened scrutiny, and Section 3 of DOMA does not meet that standard. And so we would ask the court that if it does reach the issue of DOMA, that it would find that it is unconstitutional under the Equal Protection Clause.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.